Right now, let's visit with Lise Glink from ThinkLink Media. Hi, Lise.
Hey, John.
Busy doings in Chicago.
Beautiful, oh, my goodness.
Beautiful, beautiful day. And so far, so good. But we are just moments into the DNC week. We'll see how things go. Kamala Harris is in town, and she'll be there for Joe Biden's speech this evening. And you actually had some sort of bullet points for us on what her economic rollout was from last week. What is that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. She's starting to make some plans and tell the American people what she intends to do when it comes to continuing the good economic news that we've had, although it doesn't always feel like it. So she's focusing on how you are feeling the pain of high inflation from last year, how that's come down, and what she can do to alleviate it. So some of that, for example, and she laid this out in a speech on Friday, includes a ban on price gouging, as she puts it, for groceries and food, the cancellation of medical debt, a cap on prescription drug costs, some of which was announced by the Biden administration anyway. They finally negotiated 10 key drugs that I think the government is going to save $8 billion on. $25,000 subsidy for first-time home buyers, and a child tax credit that gives $6,000 per child to families for the baby's first year of life.
I had heard some of that. Well, yeah, and the question is, how are you going to pay for that? Where does that money come from?
Oh, you want details, John. I mean, details? Really? I have no details. She has no details yet.
But I think that's telling. But I mean, I think a lot of times people campaign on things that sound good and nobody expects any of it to happen. Read my lips, no new taxes. George Bush raised taxes. But these are it doesn't surprise me to hear the Democrats saying these things, but I think it's a fair question to say who pays for these or what do we lose if we get these things?
Well, I think we can lose a lot. For example, you know, I think some of these are a little bit misguided. So the $25,000 subsidy for first-time homebuyers, I get where that is coming from, right? It's expensive to buy a house, and there just aren't enough houses out there. Well, another policy initiative she put out there last week was, we're going to build 3 million homes over the next 4 years. Hopefully that means above and beyond what we were already going to build. But 3 million houses would go a long way towards solving the problem of high home prices.
Right.
And the $25,000 subsidy, while really nice and a good maybe 10, not even 10% down payment for, you know, a typical home. It's more like 5% on the average home price, which is now over $400,000. So it's interesting, but I think if you give first-time home buyers this kind of a subsidy, it's just going to increase competition, which is just going to increase the price of homes. So I'm not sure that one makes so much sense.
Well, even if it did, and I understand why you subsidize things. We're doing it for electric cars, but I'm not sure that you can just afford these things. I wonder if were they to prioritize them, I would, nobody asked me, but I would say a cap on prescription drug costs would be where I would start.
Yeah, I think that prescription drugs are extremely expensive, and the donut, which is still a problem for a lot of people who, you know, even have sort of the government options of, you know, healthcare on healthcare.gov, you know, the minimum, when you have a high savings healthcare plan, right, or high cost plan, and you've got a health savings account, you still have a lot of money that you have to come up with out of pocket, and prescription drugs are a big piece of it. So capping that, if they could do it the way that they've done it by negotiating these 10 popular Medicare drugs and really start saving people the kind of money that the government's going to be saving, I think that would be really effective. And if that's the only thing you did, that wouldn't be so bad. That might be kind of nice. The other thing the Biden administration has gotten done this time, which I think has been effective, is medical debt was really weighing down people's credit scores. And a lot of times medical debt was reported to collection agencies because it took so long for insurers and doctors and patients to actually get the paperwork right and the right codes inputted. Yeah. And anyway, what they did is they put a 9-month moratorium on medical debt affecting your credit score and credit history. And that has had a very positive effect to raise average credit scores and typical people who had medical debt. So I don't know about canceling the debt, John, but actually just getting it off your credit history has been really helpful.
By the way, this is kind of funny. You were talking about Kamala Harris's economic plan, which would probably borrow from whatever Joe Biden and the Democrats were planning. She was obviously part of his team anyway. But in the new 96-page rollout of the party platform, in 19 separate spaces, they still refer to the top of the ticket as Joe Biden. So I guess they need to kind of proofread this thing. But I guess that's also just a sort of inadvertent reminder that what she's going to propose is maybe not that different than what we've seen in the last 4 years, or at least that Biden would have done.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at how successful it has been compared to the rest of the world. Now, I know that doesn't make people at home feel any better when you look at your own wallets, but I was with somebody at a breakfast meeting this morning who just got back from Ireland and Germany. And in Germany, which has always been the European country that everybody says works really well, right? The German trains run on time. Everything is spick and span. He said that country is struggling, and much of Europe has been struggling under the weight of inflation and the migrant issue that they've had in Europe, and of course the war with Ukraine and Russia, that's right on their doorstep. That's, you know, brought its own set of issues and problems. And so, you know, he was saying that the rest of the world is looking to the United States going, how do we emulate what they got? So I wouldn't be surprised if Kamala does just start to push forward on some of these things that they've done over the last 4 years and just bring them to the next level.
I'm sure the rest of the world would say 2.9% inflation. We'll take that. But yeah, it depends on where you live that you feel it in the United States. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So WalletHub did a really interesting study that looks at how inflation feels in individual cities. And it's surprising to find out that even though the global, and by global I mean the national level of inflation, is down to 2.9%, very close to what the Fed has wanted it to be, when they looked at 23 major metropolitan areas across the Consumer Price Index, which measures inflation, they found that different cities have different inflation rates. And so the biggest inflation problems, New York, Minneapolis, that was surprising, Detroit is number 3, Chicago is number 4, Honolulu, Hawaii is number 5. And the smallest inflation issues, Miami, Boston, Denver, Riverside, California, which is right outside Los Angeles, and Houston, Texas.
Boy, I don't see a common thread there. Boston, small inflation. That's a very expensive city. Minneapolis and Detroit, I would imagine, are not super expensive cities. Honolulu is, but I mean, there doesn't seem to be any consistency here. You're talking about inflation relative to, I guess, income or the cost of living in these places, huh?
Yeah, and how it feels to consumers, which was really, you know, part of this issue. I mean, the consumer price index change has been, has it been the highest the last month versus the 2 months before? Highest in Minneapolis for some reason, Detroit, New York, St. Louis, Atlanta. And then the lowest, you know, the cities that I mentioned are kind of in there. Last month versus a year ago, the highest, Honolulu, New York, Dallas, Seattle, Chicago, and D.C. are tied. Lowest, Phoenix, Atlanta, Tampa, Houston, Denver. So part of this is, you know, housing prices, which are really,
wondering about them.
Jumping or not, right? So that in Chicago, our housing prices actually are jumping above where the national ones are right now. We're seeing kind of a, like we often do in Chicago, a delayed response. We didn't really go up with the pandemic, like some of the other cities, like Boise, Idaho. I know I use that a lot, but it went crazy there. We're not coming down as much. So on a percentage basis, we look worse than I think we are.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about Detroit. Maybe as a percent, it's jumped up a lot, but Detroit is not a more expensive place to live than Boston. That's just a fact. One last thing here. The Federal Reserve has got a meeting in Kansas City coming up, right?
Actually, it's the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City hosting the annual Jackson Hole event.
Yeah, right.
And that's coming up this week. And that's sort of interesting, given that we've got the DNC going on as well. And money and inflation are such big talking points right now for everybody who's running for office. It'll be interesting to see if the Federal Reserve, the big speeches that are planned from the central bankers, the policymakers, academics, and economists from around the world actually will be coming here for this economic policy symposium. And they'll be discussing something that I have no idea what this means, reassessing the effectiveness and transmission of monetary policy. So how what they do works its way in and magic, or not magic, into the world, and how it changes how people feel.
Yeah. More on that later. Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media. Click on thinkglink.com. Okay, Elise, next Monday we'll visit again.
Sounds like a plan.
All eyes on Chicago today, and all ears on WGN Radio. If you want to stay tuned to what's going on, what the traffic is like, what the events are all about. If there is a conflict somewhere in the streets, you bet you'll hear it here on WGN Radio. One thing that folks are hearing is a lot of folks coming into Chicago talking tech. I guess that wouldn't surprise you. Every interest is here. Jim Dahlke is the Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. What's the tech scene doing or hearing this week?
Hey, John. Yeah, you know, as Chicago kind of prepares for its moment in the spotlight here, the city's startup and tech ecosystems are kind of doing the same, really kind of preparing to get in front of more eyeballs and kind of showing what Chicago's startup community is really all about. There's a bunch of events throughout town this week. One on Wednesday is called the Innovation House. This is taking place at MHub. MHub is the accelerator co-working space for hard tech, hardware startups here in Chicago. Their new headquarters just blocks away from the United Center. They're bringing together dozens of tech organizations in Chicago, including Tech Nexus there. And they're going to have actually 50 startups that are demonstrating different products there at their headquarters as folks come into town and get to familiarize themselves potentially with what's going on in Chicago's tech ecosystem. And actually, Stephen Chin, the co-founder of YouTube, is going to be giving some remarks there. Stephen went to the University of Illinois and then went to California to launch YouTube. But coming back to give a talk and kind of explain a little bit about what's going on in Chicago. And kind of the backdrop of this is that Chicago, you know, over the years has sort of quietly been this political tech powerhouse. You know, of course, the Obama campaign election and re-elections were headquartered here in Chicago. And the tech teams on both of those campaigns at this point are really kind of stuff of legend. They pioneered, data technologies around getting the vote out and fundraising and kind of using data to kind of better understand election campaigns, stuff that campaigns these days almost take for granted for how important they are throughout a campaign. But back in 2008, that stuff really hadn't existed. And so a lot of those folks who were a part of those tech teams in Chicago stayed in Chicago, launched new startups. Dan Wagner was on that tech team who founded Civis Analytics, which has gone on to raise over $70 million. Harper Reed was the CTO during those campaigns and has launched multiple startups and one that sold to PayPal. So lots of folks who are kind of part of that election and re-election campaign, staying in Chicago and kind of building political tech startups and other firms that are using some of the technology that they pioneered back in those campaigns.
I suppose they're going to get the politicians to swing by, or do they? Is it more like a industry convention that just happens to coincide with the DNC?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're certainly looking to get in front of elected officials that are important to your business, right? So I think that's certainly a part of this. But, I mean, really, this is just one giant, networking opportunity that would not have been available to you before. So there are just going to be people in Chicago that you're going to be able to kind of rub shoulders with that, for other, in any other situation where they wouldn't be here, right? And so I think the folks in the startup and tech community here are going to look to take advantage of that.
Was your organization involved in the sort of trying to prevent another fire from happening like happened in Maui?
Yeah, that's right. So Tech Nexus, so we are a venture capital firm. We help large Fortune 1000 type businesses invest and partner with startups. And we actually also bring that same startup collaboration to the U.S. government. So Tech Nexus has been working with the Department of Homeland Security on a project over several years to reduce the spread of wildfires. And so the DHS came to us basically and said, hey, help us find a startup and technology that helps monitor wildfires. as they begin and react before they spread and cause a ton of damage. And so we set out to source startups that could work on this issue and ultimately found a company that had technology that we thought could play a role. And we worked with them to adapt that technology specifically to identify wildfire. So that company that TechNexus worked with is called N5 Sensors. And they have just this month, we worked with us to deploy 80 sensors throughout Hawaii that can use artificial intelligence to monitor fires. The sensors effectively bring an artificial sense of smell to the forest. So we can identify when a wildfire has begun and take the earliest stages and take the proper steps to mitigate that. And so in some ways, it's better than what a camera can do because it can sense a burn before it becomes kind of large enough to be spotted on a camera. And these sensors are actually smart enough to differentiate between like a wildfire or a campfire or even someone barbecuing on a grill. And so, of course, this is a year to the date, really, after Hawaii had, the deadliest U.S. wildfire in over a century on Maui. And so now these wildfires are deployed throughout the Hawaiian Islands and are coming to the continental U.S. too in some wildfire-prone areas of the West.
111 people perished, to say nothing of the acreage lost and the homes and buildings lost. It was just amazing. It's funny. It seems like longer ago than a year, but it's just been a year now. And I think it's really interesting the way you described how your company came to be involved in this. That is, you would think if somebody had fire sensing technology and you're a government official in a fire prone area, you would know about each other, but maybe not necessarily so, huh?
That's exactly right. And that's kind of the role that we play, this connector between large organizations, between the government and startups, which often don't talk that well to one another, especially as, your head's down kind of working on the projects right in front of you, especially on the startup side. So and one, kind of fascinating part about the technology that we're able to deploy is it's not just these sensors. These sensors sit on kind of utility poles, but we also have these mobile sensors which can help with rekindling efforts. So, for example, if a fire department puts out a big blaze, they think it's done, they leave, and oh, guess what? This has actually been rekindled. Now we have to come back to the fire to put it out again. What we can do instead is put these sensors out, and that can detect if a rekindling event is taking place, get crews back even quicker, and put that fire out before it becomes worse.
Cities in Illinois are moving up the ladder in terms of tech-friendly ecosystems. Is that right?
Yeah, a new report from a local venture firm, M25, had their annual list of top startup cities in the Midwest. Chicago continues to come in at number one. It's been on the number one on that list every year since they put this together, which is shouldn't be a surprise, but and what we're seeing is some downstate Illinois cities kind of climb that ranking as well. Champaign is number 23 on the list. It's up two spots. Peoria comes in at number 33, up 13 spots. Springfield is at 50, up 11 spots. And so really what we're seeing here is that innovation is, certainly happening throughout the state of Illinois, not just in Chicago. Some of the downstate cities are seeing some momentum as well.
Yeah, good to know that. Actually, I think that's all the time I've got. We'll continue to see maybe what transpires this week, and you can catch us up as well next week then. How's that sound?
Sounds good, John. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. We've got more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new dining and entertainment concept is in the planning stages near Chicago's Magnificent Mile with a magic theme. Cranes reports an entity led by venture capitalist and former Allscripts CEO Glenn Tolman has signed a lease at 100 East Ontario. That's the space where Lowry's prime rib was located for nearly 40 years before closing in 2020. The lease runs for 10 years. The building is currently undergoing rehab work, so it's unclear when work might start on the restaurant portion. In the 1990s, Tolman tried to open restaurants in New York and Orlando, centered around illusionist David Copperfield, but the project never came to fruition. An activist investor has taken a stake in Oak Brook-based Portillo's. Engage Capital has targeted other restaurants in the past, including Shake Shack. The Tribune reports it may be seeking to change Portillo's board of directors and could force a possible sale of the company. It may also try to convince the company to open smaller, less costly restaurants. This comes as Portillo's expands to other U.S. markets. Engage Capital is now the largest single holder of Portillo's stock. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And the theme for this week is the three Ps.
Participate, prepare,
and protect.
More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. It's also a good time, as the corn and beans are beginning to turn, to think about having a safe harvest.
And our theme this year is participate, prepare, and protect.
And today begins Harvest Safety Week, and Mike Seifert is president and CEO of the National Grain and Feed Association. And let's break down those three P's.
Participating and sharing Harvest Safety Week resources, preparing for hazards during the harvest season, and protecting the employees that transform America's harvest into food, fuel, and fiber. And this is really just our way heading into the harvest season to encourage folks to take a step back, focus, and make sure they continue to think about those safety issues as they work through the year.
As we've heard time and again, farming is one of the most dangerous occupations, and grain elevators and other facilities that handle what the farmers bring in from the fields can be very dangerous places.
We've got a lot of transportation going on, rail, trucking, a lot of moving parts. Obviously, you got the augers, grain bins, folks are going into to clean, and so you got to be sure you're protecting from engulfments. You got to know the standards that are in place to address the threat of dust explosions.
And they also handle a lot of deadly chemicals for pest and disease management. Seifert says there will be videos and webinars each day this week at nfga.org/safety. That's nfga.org/safety.
Participate, prepare, and protect.
Harvest Safety Week, this week and every week, and you know the drill.
Let's be particularly careful out there.
On the food calendar, oh my, we've got some catching up to do. Yesterday was National Ice Cream Sandwich Day, National Fajita Day, and National Pinot Noir Day. Today is National Potato Day and National Soft Ice Cream Day. Celebrate responsibly. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
So what are you doing in Chicago? It's such a glorious day, and the week looks to be nice. We got a big convention in town, of course, but there's also a new exhibit at the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry. Dr. Olivia Castellini is the senior exhibit developer there. Doctor, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN.
Well, thank you so much for having me, John.
So do you do all sorts of exhibits or just this one, Notes to Neurons?
They keep me busy with all kinds of exhibits, which makes it a lot of fun for me. The museum is a great place for science stories of all kinds.
Yeah. What's the science story here, Notes to Neurons?
Notes to Neurons is all about music and the brain. So everybody listens to music. Even if you don't think you like music, you're surrounded by it all the time. And our brains and our bodies respond to that. So Notes to Neurons is all about what happens to us, what's going on in our brains, and how that sends signals to our bodies when we listen to music.
What are some examples of these signals that go back and forth?
Yeah. So have you ever gotten the chills when you listen to a song?
Right.
Or been moved to tears? Yes. So music isn't just sound that goes into your ears. So when you hear that song, my mom loves to cry at commercials, right? And so you have like the sad music that's playing, that sound goes in through your ear and is then translated into signals that stimulate your brain. And so you're activating things that are not just the parts of your brain that process sound, but also memories, your motor system. So tapping your toe or that urge to like drum your fingers along with the song. All of those areas of your brain, it's a full brain activity to listen to music. So your brain gets stimulated by those sounds, and then that brain stimulation then sends signals to the rest of your bodies. So you get like the hairs on the back of your arm stand up, your heart races a little bit. So all of that is happening in the space of a heartbeat when you're listening to music.
And what do you do at the museum to demonstrate that?
Yeah, so you actually get to experience all of that yourself in Notes to Neurons. So when you come in, we tee off. So the exhibit itself is a digital immersive space. So we have projections from the floor to the ceiling. They're on the floor. So we literally put you inside of the brain. So you can go inside a neural field and see what's happening as music plays and how the neurons are stimulated. And then we'll look at different parts of the brain based on real brain scans to see how brain is that full body activity. And then you get to see how music is affecting you personally. So we track your heart rate, and then we visualize that in real time so you can see how you are responding to the music in the exhibit.
You'd have to play my songs, though. I wonder if you've got the songs that would move me at your exhibit.
Well, we do have a little bit of something for everyone. But the really cool thing about music in the brain is that your body and your brain are going to respond no matter what. So even if it's a song that you don't particularly care for, and it might be my favorite song, both of us are going to have a reaction. But yours might be different than mine, but our brains are both going to be activated. So when you come to the exhibit, you'll hear some familiar songs in pop and blues, some hip hop and classical, even some rock music. But, you know, we do, you know, the message is that, you know, you can hear these different songs in the exhibit, but next time you do hear your favorite song, your brain, you can be aware that your brain is responding to it, just like it did when you saw the exhibit.
I bet Taylor Swift is putting off a lot of neurons and physical reactions in people these days.
She does stimulate a lot of reactions. So, yes, we did have to sneak in a little bit of Taylor Swift in the exhibit. She's a great example of some pop music. But even if Taylor isn't so much in your wheelhouse, yeah, you will have a reaction to her music.
But the converse might be true, too, I suppose. That is, suppose you played some music that would lower my heart rate, that would calm me. I suppose that's a thing, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is why we listen to music in our day-to-day lives to begin with, right? Because, you know, you may have that song, like, I know you're a runner, so you go to the start line of a marathon and they play music to amp you up. They're not playing like lullabies at the start line. But then when you go for a spa day, or you go for a quiet walk or a meditation, you're listening to something that's more tranquil, that's meant to create that response in your brain and your body that calms you down. So we do go through that in the exhibit and actually let you experience that for yourself. Yeah. In the course of going through the experience.
So you're a physicist, and you might appreciate the science of this, but I understand you're also a musician. What instrument did you play?
I play violin. I started playing when I was 5, and actually my undergraduate degree was in music, and I still play. So this is sort of this exhibit experience, sort of bringing in all of my life experiences coming together here.
And do we know exactly how it works? That is, I hear music and therefore my heart goes faster, or my heart slows down, or I'm sad or happy because of a memory. I mean, think about all of the things that happen for that to be experienced. That's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And that's one of the cool parts of this job, is I get to go talk to all of these amazing scientists, in this case, cognitive neuroscientists. And there are so many facets of music and the brain and the research that's happening.
Yeah.
So there are researchers who are looking at sort of the pleasure response. So why do you love a certain song? You know, what happens in your brain and your body? There are people who are looking at memory and cognition. You know, there's lots of incredible research around neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's.
Absolutely.
And how music can be used in therapies or to understand how the brain is functioning. So music really is a key to the human experience, right? So there's so much that we can learn just by studying the music when you're studying the brain, listening to music, you can get a lot of information and explore a lot of avenues about just how the human brain works to begin with, just by watching what happens when music is playing.
There is a new exhibit at the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry. Dr. Olivia Castellini is the senior exhibit developer. MSIChicago.org is the website. Really interesting. I'll check it out. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.